people understand that the kind of freedom that you told them they're supposed to want, they can't have with kids. And so we're looking at it and like, okay, we can either have this kind of freedom and not have a civilization anymore, or maybe we need to have a different idea of what freedom is.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, January 14th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm joined today not only by my normal co-hosts, Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, but also by special guest Dr. Brad Littlejohn. How are you three doing today?
Great. Nice to be here.
We're excited to welcome Brad to the show. He's a fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where he writes on technology policy and Protestant social ethics. He's also the founder and president emeritus of the Davenant Institute, where for 10 years he helped create resources and courses to form Christian leaders in wisdom to navigate our increasingly challenging cultural moment. He's the author or editor of 19 books, notably the forthcoming Call to Freedom: Retrieving Christian Liberty in an Age of License, which, as of this recording, officially comes out tomorrow. He's a weekly columnist at World Opinions, and his work can be found in journals too numerous to name here. Brad, welcome to Stand Firm, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about it. What is it about, and why did you feel moved to write it?
Yeah, so the idea of this book is that we use this discourse of, I mean, this language of freedom is absolutely pervasive in our politics today. In fact, I've just mentioned before we started recording, I'm right now just came from a briefing about an upcoming Supreme Court case that's also having oral arguments tomorrow, called Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. In this case, the Free Speech Coalition is a lobbying group representing the pornography industry. So in our culture today, freedom means kind of whatever we want it to mean. And in fact, that's the whole idea, is that freedom means being able to do whatever you want to do. And yet, and I think some, what we've seen is with kind of the rise of post-liberalism is kind of some conservative thinkers kind of saying, you know, maybe we need to stop talking about freedom so much, and we need to just talk about, you know, order or virtue or something like that. And we do need to talk about order. As Christians, and especially as Protestants, I don't think we can get the biblical message central to what St. Paul says about the gospel. One of the classic texts of the Reformation is Luther's Freedom of a Christian. So we need to reclaim the language of freedom. We can't just accept its modern redefinition as license. And so the purpose of the book in a theological, spiritual context, what does freedom mean in a moral context? What does freedom mean in a political context? And how is the kind of coherent Christian vision of freedom actually need to be foundational to our politics, our economics, our technology, and our life, our church life?
Yeah, I thought it was great, Brad. I think I thought it was timely. I thought it was really, I don't mean this in an offensive way, surprisingly devotional, in a sense. You know, I thought it was very, I found it very, edifying in a, from a spiritual standpoint, and sort of redoubled in my convictions and challenged in many ways. I thought particularly the section on economics was really thoughtful, and the way that you sort of push back a little bit on sort of unrestrained capitalism as an unalloyed good, which of course we see the excesses of that around the world. But I thought it was powerful insight there, that there's a Christian aspect of looking at the material wealth of the world that of course we appreciate in giving tithes and offerings, but also just the very systems itself. So that was among some of the ideas. But and then the long list of people that recommended in the beginning was across the entire spectrum of all of the who's who of sort of American Protestantism, which was really, I was heartened to see as well. But no, I thought it was really well done. And I hope that I trust it will become a valued resource for many pastors and theologians and Christians looking to equip themselves with how to think through some of these complicated political and moral issues that everyone else seems to be talking about, and now we can too.
I was reading the introduction, and you mentioned that in the West we had a pretty thoroughgoing discussion and investigation of freedom, and we'd come to some conclusions, but I guess in the contemporary era, it seems as if the riches of that historic discussion have been lost. Why do you think that's happened? What's happened in the present that has unmoored us from that discussion?
Yeah, I think what we can say is this, that freedom. So freedom exists in freedom in opposition to necessity. Okay, that when you have, there's only one thing that you absolutely have to do, then you're not free. And so we've sometimes can be deceived by that into thinking that that means that freedom is the exact opposite of necessity. If necessity is one thing you absolutely have to do, you don't have a choice about it, then freedom means you have as many possible choices as you could. Like, the more choices, the more free. And what we in fact find is beyond a certain point, you have too many choices to be meaningfully free, because you're just paralyzed by choice overload. I think it's how we kind of find ourselves today. But if you think back to a kind of pre-technological society, obviously every society has technologies, but pre-industrial revolution, pre most of the technologies that we kind of take for granted, most people's lived under conditions of largely governed by necessity. You spent most of your life just trying to stay alive. And when you, if you were lucky enough to make it to adulthood, your spouse was kind of probably chosen for you, if not absolutely chosen for you. It was pretty limited. You know, this is who you're kind of expected to marry. This is the vote. This is the career you're expected to go into. Your father's a blacksmith. You're going to be a blacksmith, right? It's just kind of, there's one pathway in life, and that's what you did, right? And if that's your kind of background condition, then any technologies or political institutions that promise to expand your options a bit, understanding that while we understood that to be a human, to live in the body, is to be subject to biological necessity. There's, you got to eat, you got to sleep, you got to, you got to visit the John, and you're subject to the law of gravity, right? To be in a body is to be subject to natural necessity. And yet we thought, okay, technology can free us from that somewhat. It can give us, we can get in a car. We can travel much further than we could ever do on our own feet, right? This expands our horizons. Now that people can have larger physical horizons, they could maybe have more possible marriage partners, and they don't have to just choose whoever their parent chose for them. And they have more educational opportunities. Maybe they don't have to be a blacksmith. So we get these increasing options, but again, starting at this background condition of, well, of course, you can't just be anything or absolutely anything. You're still subject to these kind of natural necessities. But increasingly, our technologies then begin to raise the question, well, why? Why be subject to any of these necessities? Maybe we're not subject to gravity. Maybe we can fly. Maybe, even though Silicon Valley transhumanists tell us, maybe we don't need to be limited by death. And so technology is kind of, it went from opening up some space for freedom within a kind of background conditions of natural necessity to saying, why shouldn't absolutely everything be up for grabs? Why do we have to operate under any constraints? Why don't we get to choose the conditions of our existence? And what happens then is what I talk about in the book. C.S. Lewis gives the example, the joke of the Irishman's two stoves. A certain Irishman thought that, a certain stove would enable him to reduce his heating bill by half. So two such stoves would enable him to heat his house with no money at all, right? But of course, sometimes going further in the same direction undercuts all the progress you've made. And I think that's what we find is when we use technologies to actually attack the very basis of human nature, then we lose the conditions that make freedom possible. And I think that's the condition we find ourselves in today.
That's really interesting. I mean, it seems like the narrative of our world is the Disney narrative. You're being hemmed in and not able to be your true self because of the structures around you. And so the Disney princess or the Disney hero breaks free of the mean stepmother or the
overbearing father.
Or the overbearing father. Right?
She just wants to dance.
Who ultimately is won over by the new self that's emerged from this prison. And so you're right. We've glommed that narrative on to everything, and including, like you say, just the physical realities that that exist. My wife grew up in Mali in West Africa. She's a missionary kid, and she grew up in a village without electricity, without running water. And so she vividly remembers the first time she walked into a supermarket in the United States within living memory. And she said she was just so confused and so overwhelmed. And it was a painful experience for her. It wasn't a look at all the stuff I get to choose from. It was, how am I possibly going to choose anything in this cornucopia of consumer goods? And she still doesn't like it. She still doesn't like going to the grocery store because there's just too much choice.
We have to be careful there a little bit, Matt, because that's the same apologetic that my East German teacher was using to argue that it was better under the communists.
It's not better. It's just saying
we only had one to two cars to choose from, neither which worked, and we liked it. You know, it was like,
not better than the communists, but there is some, look, conservatism, from my understanding, and based in Christian heritage, is being taught to conform to reality, being willing to.
Well, yes.
To set yourself into what reality is, and not make a new reality. That's kind of the leftist impulse, isn't it? We're gonna revolutionize everything and make a new thing. But it is counterintuitive, because freedom, it seems to be just if you ask somebody on the street, well, that's the I get to choose what I want to do, and then the more choices there are, the more freedom I have. And like, it's ironic that it's not that way.
Well, and what's interesting about it is, of course, the capacity to choose a meaningful choice requires a foreclosure of options, right? So, I mean, the most important choice of all that we make, the choice to follow Christ is the choice to follow Christ alone and no others. Then the second most important choice is the choice of our spouse, forsaking all others. Having made that choice, sorry, buddy, you don't get to keep your options open anymore. And if you want to keep your options open, then you might enjoy certain things, but you don't enjoy the good of marriage. The good of marriage requires that choosing one option and in choosing that option, foreclosing all the others. And this is, I think, where the modern view of freedom becomes so self-defeating, is we think freedom means having options. And then we realize, well, if I want to keep my options, I better not ever choose any option. Because to choose an option means I'll have less freedom after I choose that option. And I was reading this Wall Street Journal article about people in their 30s that are still aren't getting married, aren't having kids, aren't leaving their parents' basement. And the saddest thing about it is, we just sort of say, oh, these stupid kids these days, whatever. But reading it, the young people were often, or not so young people, but only a little younger than me, but we're, there's this one woman who's like, I feel like a failure, right? I don't have a job, still with my parents. And her parents are enabling this, because her parents are like, no, we don't want her to feel like she's pressured to just take the first job. We want her to be able to keep her options open and find the perfect dream job. And so in the name of maximizing her freedom, she never ever launches into life, right? She never actually gets a job, because that limits her options.
This sounds like it's like you make a distinct, you bring up the tension between negative and positive liberty. Would you define those for us so we can?
So I say negative liberty is being unconstrained by anything outside of yourself. Nobody's interfering with you. Nobody's coercing you. And that's what we tend to think, that's all that liberty is. But it also has to have this positive dimension of a capacity to act. I say a paraplegic is not free to walk around just because nobody's holding him down. He may have negative liberty, but he doesn't have positive liberty. Because he doesn't actually have the capacity to walk. And so there's this moral dimension of the capacity that we have as moral agents to undertake free actions, which can be impinged upon not just by people outside of us, but by our own sloth or slavery to our own desires. Hmm.
Would you say it? I don't mean to monopolize. If you guys want to jump in here, done fine. Would you say that too much negative liberty might make it more difficult to exercise positive liberty, liberty. So if you, again, one's telling you what to do, and you have no limitation on your behavior, then you also suddenly have a myriad of choices that you didn't have before. And so you're not going to make you're not going to have the freedom really to positively choose one woman or one, spouse or one job.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean that the you need some kind of directionality, and we see this is that like people, both in terms of the rise of the nanny state and big tech, are both actually a response to this. We're going to give you so much freedom that you don't know what to do with it. You're going to get on Netflix and you're like, I don't know what movie I want to watch. Netflix, you tell me. You tell me what movie I want to watch. Okay, I'll just, you know, let the algorithm just tell me, right? Or similarly, letting the kind of the state come in as a kind of nanny state and say, we will help you figure out what to do with your freedom because you don't even know what to do with it anymore, right? So, some kind of foreclosure of the horizons and pointing in a certain direction is necessary to actually exercise positive liberty. I talk about we think of law in a kind of liberal society. We think of political society as like this big open playing field where everybody, you know, some people are playing soccer, some people are playing golf, some people are playing football. That you know, the task of the state is to, you know, it's like a sort of referee running around trying to keep people trampling on each other. And then there's the law is like this kind of circular fence around the outside of the field. It's just like, you know, go whatever, you know, play wherever you want, but just don't go beyond this boundary. But historically, so we think sort of, you know, liberty is that sort of scope of free action, and then law is the negation of that. And the question then, we think our political debates between right and left are just like, how narrow is the fence, right? And, you know, how much room do you have to play? But historically, the role of law was seen as having this moral function of I say it's more like the bumpers on a bowling lane. You know, if you're really bad at bowling, your goal is to knock down those bowling pins, but you can't bowl straight. So therefore, it's going to zigzag, but the bumpers are going to make sure that your zigzagging behavior still roughly moves in a forward direction. And I think that is the proper relationship of law and liberty is there's this directionality, a telos to our behavior. Law does not make us moral in an absolute sense, but law does sort of guide our zigzagging behavior toward a destination.
Yeah, we talked about that a bunch with respect to like the death penalty. You know, like it's not that we'd want this to be enacted every day willy-nilly, but the existence of it does at least teach people that there are some certain crimes that in our society you will forfeit your life for. I mean, that's kind of, you know, so it's we hope it's mainly a pedagogical function as opposed to an actual enactment. But nevertheless, you know, the law does posit an ideal towards which we are hopefully moving as a society. I mean, my problem, not problem, but my question reading the book, because again, I think it's a really poignant and well argued understanding of a Christian sort of embodied Christian political actor, for lack of a better word. But, you know, the way that I see, like, for instance, you talk about the way that law has been used in the past. There was also, at the very least, a deistic, if not a sort of a nominally transcendent view of humanity that at least grounded our actions here in the possibility of some sort of afterlife, if not, you know, guaranteed judgment. I mean, really. And I think that as we, you know, my question, and it's probably not an answer, but when I was reading it was where will this limit be found other than the sort of exhaustion that will come from the pursuit of this lie to its logical end? Because outside of that, for me, I can say all I want about where limits should be and how law should be, you know, reflect the good, the true, and the beautiful. But of course, you know, we've got a whole segment of people who simply say, says you and your mythological being, you know, I'm good with my weed, my porn, and my gambling and my polyamory and whatever else that it may be. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, I forget who would say, just John Stone Street, Colson Center says, you know, ideas have consequences and consequences have victims, you know? And I think we're looking around seeing that the lie that was foisted upon the West, some, you know, I mean, you can argue where it began, but at the very least since the Enlightenment, the quote unquote Enlightenment, that, you know, either God doesn't exist or he's indifferent to your actions and your life is what you make of it, is coming to an end. I feel like we've come to the end of that, of the promise that would somehow liberate in a positive way. And we look around it, and I think the detransitioners, you know, are sort of the prophets of the ones yelling, turn around, you know, go back. And outside of that, though, I don't see like how. So I guess my question is, how do we make a compelling argument for this outside of simultaneous sort of Christian conversion? I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense. I mean, because I see the vision for it and it's beautiful, but yeah. I also, you know, see the loud contrary voices. And so,
yeah.
What are y'all thoughts about that?
I mean, I think I think the bright side of the darkness that we find ourselves in is that it's becoming more and more obvious to people what, you know, what I say in the book, kind of following St. Paul, that it's not a question of whether you're going to be in bondage to some master or not. It's just a question of which one. Right. And I think that's becoming undeniable, where people we live in a society of addiction, right? There's just the rates of pornography addiction, and people recognizing that this kind of digital addiction, they're addicted to their devices, and they understand that these things aren't really freeing them, but they know that they're being exploited for their data by the companies, that it's very profitable to keep them as highly engaged as possible. And so the myth that true freedom is just found in maximization of our consumer options.
That's right.
I think is becoming more and more obvious to people that that's false. And that I think some people are willing to accept the trade. They understand that they're being victimized by whatever the purveyor of their preferred addiction is, you know, and they're like, but that's okay. You know what? I'd rather, I understand, you know, Pornhub's profiting off me, but I'd rather just keep my porn and be a slave. I understand that the weed store is profiting off of me, but you know, I'd rather just keep my weed. But so some people are willing to do that, but I think most people don't. Most people say, I want to be free, and I recognize that this is not actually the path to freedom, and I recognize that you're in subjection to something. It's just a question of whether you're in subjection to something or someone who has your best interests at heart or not. And so the Christian call to say, renounce yourself and follow Christ, and you'll find true freedom in him, I think has a renewed resonance mm-hmm. with a contemporary culture that understands that actual self-creation is impossible.
That's right. And we're seeing that, actually. We were just talking before you came on about sort of uptick in church attendance. And, you know, there's the much heralded statistic that Bible sales were last year were an uptick, you know, for the first or not for the first time, but like, you know, among young men in particular, you know, and I think
and Wes Huff is on Joe Rogan all of a sudden.
That was actually awesome. I listened to that. That was really cool. But no, that was to my point. I think that, you know, we the old adage about going bankrupt, you know, is that you go bankrupt slowly and then all at once. And I think we have been given the challenge, the joy, the opportunity, whatever, of being Christian, you know, preachers, teachers, theologians in the all at once phase of Western bankruptcy, because because, you know, you could be forgiven for being in the 1950s, you know, 60s, you see the moon landing, you see all these things, you think, you know, oh, we're onward and upwards here, you know, all this freedom that we've had, this, you know, freedom of love, sexual liberation, you know, all of the various things that are ascendant, you know, what could go wrong? Well, you know, here we are, and we've got mass confusion, you know, mass levels of, like you said, deaths of despair and depression and things, and people looking for some alternative to the path that they've been given. And it's not to say that we do it perfectly, but we certainly have resources from which we can draw that have been well established, to your point, Brad.
I was going to add, I mean, another aspect of this that's just like everyone's talking about it now is, of course, the birth rate crisis. Nobody can deny really anymore that this is a crisis, that, you know, like, this is not a sustainable path for civilization. And it's obvious that that is a direct result, again, of this idea of freedom as no commitments, nothing to tie me down, keep my options open. I mean, there's nothing that ties you down quite like a kid, right? And so it's no wonder. It's like all these things, like, why are birth rates falling? What's like, because people aren't dumb. People understand that the kind of freedom that you told them they're supposed to want, they can't have with kids. And so we're looking at it and like, okay, we can either have this kind of freedom and not have a civilization anymore, or maybe we need to have a different idea of what freedom is, right? And freedom is actually found in a committed self-giving to the other, like that parenting is above all.
Amen. Yeah, and of course, that came about as that freedom came, quote unquote, freedom came about as a technological innovation, also just biological, you know, technology. But, you know, without that, you know, none of this, as much as you wanted to live this type of life that many do, you wouldn't be able to. But now you can. You know, Mary Harrington writes a lot about that. And so does Mary Eberstadt, yep. You know, about the yep. power of the. So yep. My question to you, it's just because we want people to buy this book. Who did you write it to? Or for, and how would you like to see it used?
Yeah, I always hate that question. Like when you're putting a book proposal together, you know, publishers like, you know, who is this book for? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, everybody, right? I mean,
6 billion people.
That's right.
6 billion people. No, I mean, I think hopefully you can attest that I've tried to write it at a level, a register that is very broadly accessible. I mean,
you mentioned Harry Potter and the
that's right.
Horcruxes. That's right.
Imperious Curse. Right.
That's right.
So it should be the sort of thing that I think any Christian who likes to read can read. It'll be, I think, you know, more challenging for some than others. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think above all, I would say it's for pastors like you who I think, they don't, maybe not pastors like you, because you guys are very thoughtful. Pastors a little, you know, a little less thoughtful than you, who on the one hand understand, okay, yeah, that like your true freedom is found in following Jesus, but then their congregants are like, well, you know, I give me options. I want, you know, like why do I have like I want the be able to choose between the early service and the late service, the contemporary service, the traditional service. I want to be able to tune into live stream if I want to. And then they want options in their own lifestyle, and they want to, you know, and if the pastor tells them, yeah, you can't actually carry on an affair on the side, you know, then they're like, you know, you're just being judgmental. Jesus loves me the way I am. Right. So many people in our churches have imbibed this worldly idea of give me options and don't judge me for how I choose to use my options. And I think pastors sometimes, again, they know that's wrong, but they might not necessarily have the language or the categories for helping their people understand. No. I do value. I do want you to have to be free. I do want you to be truly free. And this is why the lifestyle you've chosen is not freeing, mm-hmm. right? And this is why me giving you more options to choose from isn't necessarily increase your freedom. There are things that we are only free in as much as we're free to do them together. So I talk about, I mean, the blessing of corporate worship is one. It's a tremendous blessing that you're only free to experience that blessing of corporate worship to the extent that you say, I'm giving up my decision about when, and you know, I'm showing up church at this time. I'm doing this liturgy. I'm singing these songs. I don't get to call the shots. Somebody else calls those shots. And through that, I experience the freedom of doing this thing as a community. One of the distinctions I give in the book was between this individual and corporate or institutional liberty. And every church every day is having to navigate that and having to practice a kind of corporate liberty. But I think many pastors don't necessarily have the vocabulary to realize that's what they're doing. That's what the life of the body of Christ is experiencing the freedom of acting together in Christ.
Amen.
Yeah, I do think we have a lot of opportunity. I mean, the pervasive nature of technology as it is, I think does give us some ways into this conversation, because, you know, I think everybody's had the experience of, like you say, going on Netflix and you've got to invest 2 hours somewhere, right? But you've got so many choices. And so, and when you, well, maybe I want to watch this movie. Well, no, this movie is also something I've kind of wanted to watch, but then what's this one? I've never seen it. And you can go on for hours trying to select a movie.
I was going to say, that's the answer, is to just scroll through the menus for 2 hours. Then
you always just end up watching an episode of a TV show, because that's all the time you have left. That's
right. Or like a YouTube clip or something. So, and then, yeah. And the same thing with our phone. I mean, yesterday I sat down and I was going to read, but I had my phone in my hand and I started scrolling. And everyone's had this experience. You sit down to do something and you end up scrolling for, you know, 25, 30 minutes, maybe longer. And you realize, oh, I can only read for 5 minutes.
So judged yesterday. It was like 2 days ago, my 18-month-old grabbed my phone and started rubbing it with his thumbs.
Oh, no.
18-month-old.
Oh, like, yeah.
I said, I almost, I don't know. I had, I, I had a real existential crisis there for a second. I'm like, what have I done? Well,
no, but I mean, I grew up with three channels on TV, and you know like
it, that's right. You had two cars. We only had one. Our whole apartment complex only had one phone, and we liked it.
But no, but I was saying it's. I think there's a way in to talk about this because everybody has had those kinds of experiences, and so we can use those things to illustrate the difference between negative liberty and positive liberty, and what why make making a choice is so hard right now. And for pastors, I think there's like illustrations all over to help explain what freedom is, and what freedom isn't.
Amen. I think, Brad, I think it's great. Like I said before, I think it's a commendable book. I think it's you largely succeeded. It seems in what you were attempting to do from the outset that you put. And I think it's worth the price simply for the bibliography. I thought it was, rich. And clearly you've been writing this book for your entire adult life. You know, it seems it's a compendium of a lot of different areas come together in just a very readable. It's accessibly linked. You know, I mean, it doesn't take forever to read. And I hope, you know, pastors do pick it up and read it. I think that, you know, some of the discussions around COVID and masking and some of the discussions around obviously capitalism, pornography, and all these things that are right front and center in our congregations, we need to reflect on where we've been and where we are and where we're going to go. And I think this is what that really helps. It's a good resource in that respect. And so I'm actually going to put a big order in for our bookstore. So next time you're back down here, yeah, when you're down here on a Sunday, I'm going to grab you and you can come and make a pitch.
Yeah, love to.
Right before we wrap up, why don't you just sort of run through the set of topics that you cover in the book, just a broad overview, give our listener a pitch for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book has seven chapters. I always try to do everything in sevenfold patterns. Peter Lighthart, my theology teacher, saw sevens everywhere. So I do too now. So the first chapter just kind of maps out what do we mean by freedom and distinguishes these different inner, outer of it. And then I give three different kinds of freedom, spiritual freedom, moral freedom, and political freedom. And then the final three chapters are kind of case studies in light of these distinctions. What does this mean for how we think about our relationship to technology? Chapter five, our relationship to the market in chapter six, and then the key issue of religious liberty, which is a, hot button issue today. And one of the things I want to kind of push people on a little bit is it's very important that while Christians are, the freedom to do whatever I have an opinion, I feel strongly about, religious liberty has to be anchored in an actual religious tradition, not just in, I have my own religious liberty to worship God and in my own way, whatever that is. So that's chapter seven of the book. So yeah, there could be, lots of other case studies that you could make, but I feel like those are the kind of three most hot button cultural issues today I wanted to touch on.
Well, that's great. I've read the intro, the first chapter, and the conclusion. I can't wait to read all of it. I'm sure our listener will run right out to the bookstore and get it. We hope so. It's really helpful and good news, I think, for pastors who are seeking to, like you said, give their congregants the vocabulary to interact with this world that promises one thing that it cannot deliver. We had a couple of technological issues ourselves there, probably exacerbated by the fact that you are in a closet on a dying computer, but we are so grateful to talk to you, Brad. We are grateful as well to our listener for listening to Stand Firm this week. As always, if you want to keep the conversation going, you can be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media, join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to JD Koch and Matt Kennedy. Special thank you to Brad Littlejohn. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.